Shabbat Shalom, everybody. I want to thank Congregation Beth Emanuel for all of your efforts in hosting this big conference, this big First Fruits of Zion conference that we had here over the previous week. It was a lot of work. I know it was a lot of work. It was a great deal of tireless effort. I would say tireless effort, except I saw a lot of tired people. So I guess it wasn't tireless effort, although you continued to put yourself forward past being tired. So I wanted to formally thank everybody who made efforts towards hosting the conference. The board of directors, most of you probably don't even know what's going on with the board of directors, and for the most part, I don't either. But the board of directors put in a lot of extra meetings in getting a lot of things done, a lot of business to be settled, including the roof and the details of the sanctuary and all sorts of additional details that had to be considered in hosting this event. And then there was this crew that came in here and built this, took out the old stage here and did all this and opened up the apse back here, and those doors are gone, and they had to re-sheet rock and rewire everything, and rebuild and their carpet, and it's beautiful and all that sort of thing. So that took a lot of attention, that took a lot of time, a lot of details, and then there was everyone who came to the work day, more than one work day in fact, and in prepping the building. The building needed, it was a lot of things that just needed to be done anyway ever since we moved in, so it's good that we had this excuse to force ourselves to get some of this stuff done. But nevertheless, it was really great to have so much of the congregation turning out and chipping in and everybody helping. There was the kitchen help. Those of you who committed to serving and the food prep and setting out the tables and creating these wonderful meals. We had never had such service at a First Fruits of Zion conference. We'd never had an abundance of food and such such kosher food, such a high standard. It was fabulous. All of that was fabulous. Those of you who worked on the sound, the lights, that kind of thing, the production, those of you who were cleaning and hosting and taking care of the physical needs of the building, opening and closing the building, staying here till the last dog was hung, and that sort of thing. Those of you who put efforts in for the concert Thursday night, the band, Troy, Chris for the cantering, the prayer services, all of the readers who practiced and honed up their canting skills to do the big Aliyot on Shavuot, the Shavuot Aliyot. Troy for all of his I told Troy just be ready for anything, and then I would just kind of like tell Troy, okay, sing a song, do something, he would just have to kind of be like always on call. So he made himself available for that. So for all of the innumerable details of hosting an event of such proportion, there's like details that you don't even think when you're thinking of doing something like, oh, that'd be fun. You don't even think like, where are we going to get the extra chairs? Stuff like that. It's all sorts of, and who took care of these things? Well, I sure didn't. Somebody else did, so we want to extend, I want to extend thanks. I know Boaz wants to extend thanks to everybody. And I'm very proud of you, Beth Emanuel. I'm very proud of you as a congregation for you accomplished my objective in hosting the event here. And that I hoped that we would set a good example. I hoped that we would set a good example for people with a display of love and servanthood that would be worthy of the Master, like the Master who said, I came to serve, not to be served. And so too, you showed this same spirit of Yeshua's, this spirit of servanthood. For many people that were in attendance, this was their first real community experience, perhaps their first exposure to a Torah community. They're living out in isolated pockets here or there, or small communities of less than a dozen. You do not realize how rare you are, Beth Emmanuel. How unusual it is to find a solid Torah-based community. And we spoke about this some at the conference, and it's symptomatic of how young this movement actually is as we have moved into our second decade of existence. But we are still a small and growing, definitely growing, but a small and immature move of God's people. I thank you. I want to thank you, Beth Emmanuel, for making all of my co-workers, all of my colleagues at FFOZ regret making the decision to move the headquarters to Marshfield, Missouri. So I hope that you also, I hope that you also benefited from the experience. I hope that each of you benefited from the experience of hosting this event. I hope that you learned some things. I hope you learned that you are not alone, that we are not alone, that there are others out there like you and on very, very similar paths and from very similar backgrounds and arriving at very similar destinations. That alone, I know, is always an encouragement to see there's others on this journey with us. And I hope that you realize that the traditionalist approach to Torah, the traditionalist approach to Messianic Judaism, is not limited to a few families, to a few rare individuals here and there. But it is the general trajectory of the Messianic movement. I hope that was a good thing that I was hoping everybody would have an opportunity to see. There, my friend Glenn Shulgin, who A.K.A. Zave, told me this amusing story on his first day here. He said he was passing by and overheard a conversation where there were some. He was the man with the crutches, and he was passing by and heard this conversation where some people who were I don't know who it was, but they're making a comment about, we have to meet we have to accommodate the Heckscher Club or something like this, the Heckscher Club. And he said, "Are you nice to people in the Heckscher Club?" Because I'm in the Heckscher Club. So I thought, well, that's amusing. But, the Heckscher Club being those who are eating only, only certified kosher. That was a good thing. It's good for you. It's good for all of us to see, the trajectory of things and to begin to feel okay with people with different standards and so on. And that's another thing, is the great diversity. This is, you only get a chance at an event like this to see the great diversity of people involved in the Torah movement. Many people were at this conference who were new. Like, this was their first event. Their first big Messianic event. Can you imagine if you attended the conference and if you heard the lectures? Can you imagine? I mean, this would be like being absolutely, it's like your first day of swimming lessons and being tossed into the deep end, for sure. Because, the material was, it was not on a 101 friendly introduction level, not at all. There were people here also who were not new, but who were on a different course. For example, there were people who were counting the Omer according to the Sadducean reckoning. There was a contingency of people then who, for them, Sunday was Shavuot. So here's the interesting thing about that: you didn't hear any ruckus about it. There wasn't any argument, people trying to pass out literature or something and sway half the congregation or half the community over, you're on the wrong day, you're counting this wrong, or something like this. So what I hope that represents for you is to see that there can be diversity, there can be different opinions, and yet maturity and unity in the greater bond of peace, the greater bond of Messiah. And that's the key. In the end, God, I don't think, is going to really care how you counted the Omer or which day you kept Shavuot on. He's going to care how you treated your brother and how you treated your sister. And that's a matter of love. That's a matter of respect. Love has to be the final product of what we're doing. It has to be our first goal and our final product. If our efforts to keep God's Word, to follow God's Torah, do not result in love, you know, we're wasting our time. There are other paths that would be a quicker route to love. So I hope you remember, in addition, you know, other things that you might have gathered here. I hope you also remembered why what we are doing, why what you're doing, why your participation here is important. That what's going on is a matter of, it's universal in scope. That we aren't talking about forming Protestant denomination number 33,256, because that's about the number of Protestant denominations in the world today. That's not what we're talking about. We're not interested in starting a new denomination. What we're interested in is a complete and total restoration, going back to the very beginning, going back to the very foundation of discipleship, going back past the Reformation, past the Church Fathers, and past Ignatius, all the way back to square one, the community of the apostles, a matter of discipleship. So I hope that the conference was able to, you know, that's sort of like to trigger that realization. You might have felt, if you attended the seminar, if you attended the lectures of the conference, you might have felt like, whoa, this stuff's over my head. You know, maybe it felt like we were raising questions that you had never had. You know, it's like this is supposed to be a real faith-building, faith-strengthening time, and you came, and then we were like shaking up your faith. You know, it might have felt that way. I know some people said it felt that way, but that was the nature of the material we were discussing. We did a conference. This is the idea. We're going to do a conference that specifically focuses on reasons not to believe in Yeshua. It focuses on anti-missionary objections to the gospel. And the reason I think that's important, even if it's stuff that you would never encounter before or consider before, is I think it's important because I believe the uninvestigated faith is not worth believing. If you just believe what you believe because that's what you believe and you never ask yourself, why do I believe what I believe? And does what I believe make sense and hold up? What's the point in believing it? Yeah? So it was difficult material. It was definitely difficult material. It was not a pump you up, feel good kind of event, you know? It just wasn't, because we're dealing with some very, very serious topics. Cause for serious concern. But you should also know this, there were others present who indeed have been wrestling with these questions. And I can think of half a dozen people from Beth Emanuel who left over the years that we have been a congregation in order to convert into Judaism. So, yeah, it's difficult material. Wasn't exactly like, you know, it wasn't. When I go to a conference or something like that, I like to maybe go for a spiritual high or something. This was more like FFOZ conferences are typically like this. It's always deep study. I hope that the material presented at the conference also might have given you a greater respect for Judaism, in that you might have come away from it realizing, you know, because one of the oversimplifications I always hear from people is like, well, why are the Jewish people so blind? Why can't they just see that Jesus is obviously the Messiah? So maybe by hearing the actual objections, hearing the reasoning, you realize that these objections actually are substantive. They're not lightweight things. They are serious considerations. Moreover, and perhaps most importantly, I hope that you realize in hearing Jewish objections to Jesus, Jewish objections to Yeshua, the main objection, the main problem that Judaism has always had and will always have with Yeshua and the concept of Yeshua as Messiah is not the gospel. It is not the scriptures. It is the traditional Christian Jesus who rejects the Torah and who leads people away from obedience to the scriptures. So that was the seminar. We chose this difficult material. We chose this material because First Fruits of Zion, we're committed to seeing this whole thing work long term. And we're looking towards long term survival. We've always been looking toward the next generation and the generation after that. I don't know, but have you ever asked yourself, how many of you who are in attendance here today think that you will be in attendance in a congregation like this or this congregation or someplace like this in 10 years? If you look around, if those of you who have been here 3 years, if you were to look around, how many faces would you recognize from 3 years ago? And do you expect that your children will walk in faithfulness to God's Torah and discipleship to Yeshua? Do you expect that your grandchildren will walk in faithfulness? Will your granddaughter and her husband be keeping Shabbat? Will your granddaughter light Sabbath candles? These are serious questions. These are serious questions, and these are the questions that concern us. And this is why we're running ahead, and this is why we're pushing, we're scouting out ahead, we're foraging ahead, saying, look out, there's a pit up here. You don't want to go this way, you got to go this way. This is why we're constantly pushing the envelope, because to be comfortable, to just relax and be comfortable, is to lose our grasp. And we can only find balance in tension, as Boaz said. Sociologically speaking, I've said this before and I'll say this, I feel a sermon forming. Sociologically speaking, we are doomed. This is true. Sociologically speaking, as a movement, Messianic Judaism is doomed. You know, I see what's going on in other Messianic congregations. I see the Messianic congregations that have been established for 10 years. Their kids, Messianic Jewish kids, are not walking it out as they grow up. As they grow up, they go into the church, or not at all, or into nothing. We're doomed because we are, again, you know, we're positioned between these two great mammoth magnetic religions of Judaism and Christianity. And people are always falling off to one side or the other, or saying, to heck with both. Nothing. I'll take nothing. Sociologically, we do not have a prayer. A sociologist would look at what we're doing here and say, it's an aberration. A blip on the radar. But they would have said the same thing. They would have said the same thing regarding the original faith in Messiah, regarding the kingdom of heaven, because there wasn't a chance. You had two great religions. There was Roman polytheism, and there was Judaism, and there was this small group of people who had like fallen off of both. And we're still here today. And God does things like this. God is not a sociologist. And this is a matter of faith. That the kingdom of heaven grows. And once it is put in motion, it cannot stop. It cannot be stopped. Faith says, we are not doomed. We will grow. But it's going to take commitment. It's going to take effort. And that's what I want to speak to you about today from the Parsha. If you could turn to Numbers chapter 11, please. It says this: now the people became like those who complain of adversity. I love the way the New American Standard puts this into English. The people became like those who complain of adversity. It doesn't say they became those who complain of adversity. Just they became like those who complain of. You guys, we're not really complainers. We're just like complainers. Not, I like that. I'm not really a sinner. I'm just like a sinner. It's similar. There are similarities between us. The people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord, and when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of them at the outskirts of the camp. And the people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of that place was called Tavera, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. The incident at Tavera is related to us in these three short verses that I just read. The people begin to complain. The Lord hears their complaining. He responds by burning up some of them with fire. And this is the basic storyline for the book of Numbers over and over again. In story after story, Israel's discontentment gives rise to murmuring, evil speech, and sometimes outright rebellion. It's always met then with sound punishment. This is the first story of how evil speech, complaining, and discontentment leads to such punishment. There's two similar stories immediately following in this same Torah portion. The rejection of the land and the 40 years of wandering, and the story of Korah's rebellion in the following Torah portions also, if you look, they follow the exact same pattern. The pattern is actually a very familiar one to congregational leaders, to people who have been around congregations for a long time. And it's not just in religion, it's also in the workplace. It's just wherever human beings tend to congregate. Human behavior, being what it is, always drifts towards discontentment and criticism. I don't know why this is, but you know, a child comes out of the womb crying and complaining. It's like our first reaction to life. And I believe that this is actually a God-given function of the human psyche. Because we do live in a fallen world. We do. And we are to partner with God in the process of fixing the fallen world. We are to be repairers of this world. This is called tikkun olam, fixing the world. But in order to do so, in order to be fixers of the world, you know, the first thing is to troubleshoot it. You call a plumber, you know, and say, hey, you know what, the hot water's out or something. First thing he has to do is figure, let's see, it could be the water heater, yeah, probably. You know, he's got to figure out where the problem is, right? So in order to do so, in order to fix the world, we need to have a critical faculty that can detect flaw and imagine improvement. And we do. God gave us this. He gave us this ability for the purpose of improving the world. Therefore, we recognize shortcomings and we do what we can to correct them and to improve things. However, this God-given impetus to recognize problems, I believe, has malfunctioned. Because under sin's influence, our natural ability to discern a problem has been warped to become a critical, self-serving spirit which discerns problems. Now, what's a problem? A problem is something that contradicts my will. A problem is something that interferes with my whim. So no matter how good our lives are, and wealth proves this, all those stories of people who win the lottery prove this, no matter how good our lives are, we will find some reason for discontentment. We will find some reason for unhappiness. We're quick to observe that, here's the thing, here's the proverb, the real proverb, every silver lining has its cloud. Our shrewd powers of analysis are able to detect imperfection and character deficits in every single human being we meet. It's like this amazing, I have this amazing ability. I can tell what's wrong with somebody as soon as I meet them. What is that about? Well, he's a nice guy, but, you know what I mean? So no matter what the situation, we can always find something. We can always find something to complain about. How are you doing? Could be worse. I worked for an Orthodox Jew once. He had reasons to complain. I mean, he has like constantly businesses failing around him and that sort of thing. Family living in poverty. So I always say, "How you doing?" You know, just friendly. "How you doing?" He'd always say, "Excellent, thank God." He was never doing excellent, thank God. But he refused. He consistently refused to be bullied by circumstances into murmuring and complaining. As Western culture drifts further away from values like loyalty and commitment, the basic flaw of human nature is working havoc in every human institution. We have a critical spirit of ingratitude and discontentment that eventually destroys jobs. It'll get you fired. Destroys marriages. It'll destroy your marriage. Your marriage will end in divorce. It destroys families. It breaks up families, creates bitterness between families. It destroys congregations. The book of Numbers is very much concerned. This is the whole theme of the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers is concerned with correcting this errant human tendency towards complaining, towards discontentment, and towards criticism. So in each of the stories, we're told how the children of Israel complain about one thing or another, and we're told, and God was listening. God heard it. And the first thing we are to learn from these stories, then, is that God is listening. That our complaining is not just complaining to each other, but God, we're complaining to God. When we complain, it's not just a complaint, "You know what, I'm just telling you how it is." It's actually a complaint against God. So before we open our mouths to complain or criticize, we need to remember God is listening. Based upon the stories of the book of Numbers, it would appear that there's very few things that irritate God more than a negative attitude. He reacts quicker and with more divine fury against complainers than he does against people who make golden calves. A cynical, critical heart is a wrong heart. God has a zero tolerance policy towards complainers. And so Paul urges us, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 10, he urges us not to grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. He says, "Do not grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example. They were written for our instruction." Paul is the best example in all of this. He learned to find contentment. Paul learned to find contentment and joy in whatever circumstances, in whatever circumstances he was in. That's what he says in Philippians 4:11. And he says, "I am well content with weakness, with insults." Are you content with insults? When people slight you, intentionally slight you, are you okay with that? Are you okay with that? Paul says, I'm okay with that. Sure. You want to take a pop at me? I'm okay with that. With distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Messiah's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. 2 Corinthians 12:10. And when he's writing to Timothy, he confides that godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. So in other words, Paul says, it's not enough to just be like striving for godliness, to be like the holy person. I'm going to be a holy person. That has to be with a spirit of contentment. And that's where it becomes a means of great gain for oneself. Let's read on in the Torah a little bit. Verse 4, it says, "The rabble who were among them had greedy desires." Have you ever asked yourself, in this congregation, or any congregation you find yourself, am I in the rabble or not? Would I be like in the rabble? The rabble, who were among them, had greedy desires. And also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlics. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna." Manna was the perfect food, like I told the kids. Even without the rabbi's embellishments, manna is a food provided directly from heaven. But after a year of a steady manna diet, the Israelites have begun to long for things they used to know. So in actuality, there was really nothing wrong. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with manna. The only thing wrong with manna is that it wasn't fish or cucumbers or melons or leeks, onions, garlic. Can you imagine living without garlic? So it wasn't what they desired. So they spurned it. And even though it was something that had come straight from Shemayim, had dropped from heaven. The same thing happens to us. The same thing, we could all tell the same story. The same thing happens to us when we take on a life of discipleship, a life of discipleship to the one who descended from heaven. For a while it's fresh, for a while it's new, it's exciting, it's invigorating, and each day is filled with new discovery. But after a period of time, the novelty wears off. We begin to miss the old vices, the old entertainments, that sort of thing. We begin to feel nostalgic for the ways of life that we turned our backs on. And when this happens, and it's normal that it does, don't feel like you're abnormal, my heart is... It's normal, that's okay, it's normal. But when this happens, the answer is not to say, "Well, I think I'm going to go back to what I was doing before." The answer is to press on all the harder in pursuit of our righteous Savior. It's normal for the heart to yearn for straying. That's a human heart. But it is not normal for the believer to stray after the heart. The head is supposed to rule the heart. And Messiah is our head. We know better if we will press on. If you press on, you'll discover further joys. If you press on, there's greater depth ahead. There's new thrills after the thrill is gone in the pursuit of God. You know, this could be compared to a marriage. The initial thrill of chemical attraction wears off pretty quickly. There's some sort of pheromone response between human beings that, you know, lasts for I don't know how long, a couple months, a couple years, I'm not sure. But you know, that wears off. It does. But the committed couple stays together even when the thrill is gone. The committed couple stays together out of a sense of loyalty. And because they do, they later discover greater depths of love, attraction, and fulfillment with one another than those who just run from chemical rush to chemical rush, calling it infatuation or love or, you know, the skipping heart or whatever it is, will ever do. Believers enter the Torah movement from a variety of denominational and religious backgrounds. We come from all over the map. And typically, when they do, they commit to a life of Torah, which they pursue with a proselyte's zeal. You know what a proselyte's zeal is? It's like people who grew up in a faith or something. It's like, I remember when I was going to be Catholic, I tried converting to Catholicism once. And the priest was saying, you know, not about me, because I never made it. But he was kind of warning about evangelicals who convert to Catholicism. He says, you know, they come in and they're more Catholic than the Catholics, you know, because everybody who grew up in the Catholic Church is just, you know, they're doing the Catholic stuff, but the evangelicals come in and they're like, you know, they're all like on fire. And it's crazy. Creates a lot of problems. So we have the same, we have that same psychology going on in the Torah movement. People, they convert to this Torah path of discipleship, Messianic Judaism. And they bring with them a sort of proselyte zeal. Old ways are tossed aside. Old modes of worship and theology are discarded in favor of the generous portion of truth, which for a long time it seems like it just descends daily. It's like it's magic. It's like it's there every day. It's like fresh. It's like there's this, my brother's has been like feeding Torah Club to his Baptist pastor. And his Baptist pastor's like, I have a whole new Bible. He's just so excited, you know. And for a while it's like that. It's like, you know, the scriptures are just opening up and it's like, this is a color TV, you know. Everything changes. Your calendar, your holidays, your days of worship. And pretty soon your friends and your rhythm of life and the places you go and your style of worship, the entertainment you watch, everything's different. Even the food you eat is different. And for a while that's exciting maybe. But it's normal, at a certain point, to long for some of the old things. To long for the things you left behind. And believers in the Torah movement often feel bewildered by the strangeness of the new world that they've entered. It's a bewildering experience, and there's all these strange cultural shifts and all of this Hebrew and these... And they reflect back, we do, I do a lot, on a simpler life. A simpler day and age when a Sunday morning worship service was the full extent of the expression of faith. It was easier. And we long for the simplicity we once knew. And we remember the fish we used to eat free in Egypt and the cucumbers. And the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlics. But the manna on which we now feed is the one who has descended from heaven, the bread of life. And he beckons us to eat of him alone, and to follow him alone. Because this is the way to life. He alone has the words of life. Shabbat Shalom.